Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to the broadcast. Today is August 31st, 2020. Tonight's Evoke Therapy broadcast is about families, for siblings. It's really about any question you have on any topic, but we specifically open it up to family members and friends of Evoke if it's something that you think might be helpful to them. Also, if you have a question that maybe a family member has asked you or is asking you, you're welcome to ask me that, and I'm happy to give you my answer. You can compare that to yours. If you are a family member or you're asking for it on behalf of a family member, please let me know your relationship and age to the client. That way I can suit my answers specifically to the audience. We'll always get to the pre-submitted questions first, so we'll get to those before we get to any live questions, which you could submit at any time to Malia, who is moderating for me this evening. So I have a couple of pre-submitted questions. The first one: recently, when I have seen gaslighting in my family, somebody writes, I've begun to call out my kids and once my wife about this. My kids have made fun of my attempts to be a psychologist. My wife told me to stop talking psychobabble to her. And yet, in spite of resistance and seeming dismissal of what I am saying, I do think that there have been positive results. My daughter knows I don't think it is okay if she calls her younger sister a psycho, if the younger sister gets heatedly angry during an argument. Have you any suggestions on the do's and don'ts when discussing such new insights with family members? You know, it's a great question. My first thought is you're bumping up against the defense. You know, when you identify a new tool, a new insight, a new skill, and your family responds this way, all you're seeing is the defense. And so you can become a little bit more artistic about the way that you bring it up. And in the end, when they accuse you of using psychobabble, or they accuse you of therapizing them, just fall on the proverbial sword. Just acknowledge that you're getting it wrong or that you're becoming indoctrinated. Really just lean into the idea that you can't get it right. Lean in to the idea that you can't win. And so you really give your family the opportunity to just express the defense. What you're also seeing with your family is you are seeing that even though they have a defense or some resistance up, you're also seeing that the ideas are taking root. These ideas are a seed that is beginning to sprout. So, and then I think as we think about getting more artistic, more do's and don'ts, you just kind of say it less forcefully, less intensely. It's really valuable with these kinds of insights. It's really valuable to strike while the iron is cold. If we strike while the iron is cold, we're not really engaging them at a time when their nervous system is going to be upregulated. So striking while the iron is cold is, of course, a play on words, a play on an old idiom, which says, don't bring it up in the heat of the moment. Don't bring it up when people are likely to have their nervous system on high alert, or they're going to feel threatened or upset by it. And again, you can kind of talk about these kinds of things in a self-effacing way. Or with the example of gaslighting, you can talk about it without using the terminology. I think the terminology can be triggering. You know, gaslighting is a term that comes up in our family discussions also sometimes. And talking about it in ways like, I'm going to feel the way I feel, or don't tell me how I'm feeling is crazy. You know, I think those can be more, that demonstrates a more maneuverability on your part. So you can talk about the idea without using the jargon. And as it becomes more natural to you, that will become easier for you. So strike while the iron is cold. Strike while the iron is cold is a key point. Get rid of some of the jargon. Know that you're going to bump up against their defenses no matter what, and realize that the seed is planted. And then self-effacing language, either as you introduce it or after they call you out on it, can be really helpful. Because you're not trying to be right. You're just trying to be yourself. My family accused me some years ago of being a therapist. And what I kind of learned was just to accept the fact that I'm going to be clumsy as a therapist, and sometimes I'm going to sound like a therapist. And so once I become self-deprecating, the fight is over, right? Because then I'm not trying to be right or good. I can be a numbskull. But like I talk about in my book, the premise of the new book is you don't get to be right or good anymore, but you do get to be a self. And so that's really the essence, the principle that I'm talking about. All right, the next pre-submitted question. You often talk about being in a safe and being a self. You often talk about being a self and choosing one's path based on one's authentic self. You say that guilt and shame are not reliable guides for morality. How does this approach to life choice to square with what is considered moral behavior for sexuality? Would the approach you advocate give license to extramarital affairs and other practices which conflict with what is considered moral sexual behavior in our society? This may be a difficult question to discuss in a public podcast, but I'd appreciate it if you could share some thoughts on the question. So I have a couple of thoughts about this question, and I'm going to kind of take them one at a time. The first thought is that being unfaithful in a marriage, practicing dishonesty in a marriage, isn't being your authentic self. Right? If you're lying, the problem is authenticity. And I've worked with many clients over the years who have confessed, admitted to going outside of the marriage romantically. And oftentimes they've come to therapy with a history of pretty intense guilt. And they've also come to therapy with having made the effort to try and stop the behavior. And what I've learned about my work is it's like a lot of things that we think about stopping. The trick in therapy it's often not about not doing something, but it's about doing something else. And so what I talk about with these clients is, what do you need to do to live a more authentic, honest, courageous life, a relationship? And we talk about the therapeutic idea of fighting within the relationship, because somebody that goes outside of the relationship and lies about it, hides it, is just not dealing with the relationship. Right there, in a way, trying to make everybody happy by keeping the peace inside of the marriage and then finding the need met outside of the marriage. And so authenticity is lost, honesty is lost. And what we talk about is you kind of have to fight, therapeutically speaking. You kind of have to fight inside of the marriage. You have to practice being your authentic self. And if you can be your authentic self, one of a couple of things is going to happen, or a few things. Number one, the marriage is going to really go to the next level. You guys are going to work together to provide safe spaces for each other, and you'll fall in love more deeply than you ever have. Or you'll find that it's not the right place for you. If you can't live in a marriage that feels safe and nurturing and supportive, if it feels toxic or abusive to you and you have to get out of it, then you can get out of it. And then you can pursue other relationships. And so this is just the scared way of dealing with it. This is just the person who's frightened in dealing with it and not dealing with it head on. The other point that I want to make about morality and when I talk about guilt and shame, people assume that leaves you with no motivation for morality. And what I talk about constantly is love and compassion and empathy are all wonderful motivations for morality. So in this example, if I love my partner deeply, I can stay in the marriage and I can work at it. But if I'm motivated by that love, if that love is a motivating love, I'm not going to lie. And the wonderful thing about love and compassion and empathy is it doesn't necessarily rob me of my self-love. So that doesn't mean I have to be a doormat. It doesn't mean that I, in fact, technically speaking, what we believe spiritually is, I can't really love you any more than I love me. And so love is a feeling of abundance. I love you and I love me equally. And that means that I both want to be kind and empathic towards you, but I also don't want to remain in a relationship. I don't want to remain in a relationship where I'm not getting taken care of, where it's not okay, it's not safe for me. And so the shift away from guilt and I thought about this recently. I've been thinking about this idea about guilt recently. People are constantly battling their guilt. The guilt is constantly, on a day-to-day basis, telling us what we should and shouldn't do. And like I've said, it often lies to us. It tells us not to set boundaries. It tells us not to practice self-care. It tells us not to tell people the truth because we fear hurting them, not set a boundary with our child because we're afraid that they'll feel pain or sadness or sorrow. When you aren't driven by guilt, but you're driven by love, you can learn to tell the truth in your relationships in a kind and courageous way. So guilt is, and it's more and more and more clear to me that guilt is a pervasive psychological problem. And I think what makes it more insidious than anything is we are told and taught that it is related to morality. And I can think of hundreds and thousands of examples of right things to do that would cause me or others to feel guilty. And when you have something that is that obviously not a moral reference point, then you kind of have to abandon it because you have no idea what it's telling you. And in the examples that I'm talking about where people feel guilt for doing the right things, it comes from the wounds, the scars of their family of origin, the messages of our culture. So if something is that unreliable and we're taught that it relates to morality, we have to get rid of it and we have to replace it with other sources that are more reliable and consistent, like love, like compassion, like empathy. All right, I hope I'm coming through clear. Like Malia pointed out, I'm coming to you from a remote location for this week. And so my audio and video is a little bit, my internet is a little bit touchy. Next question, live question. Are there any insights you can share about successfully setting up your family for success when an adult child is coming home after wilderness and treatment? The simplest answer is just make sure that you have established a practice for your own work. I mean, that's almost universally true, really, of all of this, but practice your own work. I can't emphasize this enough to all of you. And I don't want to beat anyone over the head with it, but just that's the solution. I've been thinking about this the last few days because of a conversation with a friend. You know, when we really dive into and make our work, our therapeutic work, our discipline, when we explore our family of origin, when we challenge the notions that we were taught to believe about life and relationships, when we become critical of the voices that have been planted in our head by the other people in our lives, when we find somebody that can hear us and see us and help us discover, help us evoke from deep within our authentic selves, the world just kind of shifts. It tilts. Pain doesn't go away. Sadness doesn't go away. Hurt doesn't go away. Fear doesn't go all the way away. But there is an underlying new baseline of hope, of optimism, of freedom, of empowerment. And how can it not be so when we realize that we are the reasons that we're unhappy, that the way that we're living our life in large part is the cause of our unhappiness? We are, in that awareness, we are empowered. And so do your work until this makes sense, and then you will be free. And you'll be much, much more effective in leading and guiding the people that you love and that you care for, that you have stewardship over, like your children. You'll become much more effective at encouraging and supporting other people in their growth and change. So do your work. Get into Al-Anon. Get into Codependents Anonymous. Get into Families Anonymous. Get into ACA, that's Adult Children of Alcoholics. Get into a support group, get a therapist. Continue to listen to the podcasts until it makes sense. And when it makes sense, you'll know what I'm talking about is true. And it takes a long time. See, my work at Evoke, our work at Evoke, Evoke is not about giving you a few bits of advice or solutions or techniques or skills. All of that happens throughout all of this process, obviously, but it's about showing you, teaching you that there's a fundamental shift. You know, we use a lot of Joseph Campbell's philosophy. If you don't know who he is, go ahead and Google him and watch the movie Finding Joe in the next few days. It's a remarkable movie, Finding Joe. In fact, it's free the producer put it for free on YouTube. So watch Finding Joe. Patrick Solomon is the one who created the film. But Joseph Campbell talks about this spiritual awakening. He says, and it's so fundamental to us that it's a transformation. We see the world differently. It shifts ever so slightly. And everything changes in us. And that's the kind of change that we're talking about at Evoke. We're talking about a shift, a different way, a different sensibility, a different way of being in relationship to our children, to our spouses, to our friends, to our coworkers, to our employees, to our parents, to everybody. And it's about being a self and all that that entails. And then what comes out of being a self is learning how to relate to other people. And when we know what it means to be a self, we relate to other people, again, fundamentally differently. So that's my answer to the question. Next question. I'm trying to figure out how to moderate my younger son's directness with my 17-year-old at RTC, at Residential Treatment Center. He's saying things like, I'm glad you are better. And my older son takes it as an expectation. I think I would empower the individual, the son at the Residential Treatment Center. I would ask him questions. I would become curious with him. I wouldn't step in and try to moderate the relationship between the two of them. You could also, again, thinking of that principle I was sharing earlier about striking while the iron is cold, you could also, at a moment when the discussion wasn't happening, share some of your thoughts and ideas with the younger one. But I wouldn't jump in and try to moderate it in real time. I would get curious, empower, and encourage the young man, the son that's at the Residential Treatment Center. I would encourage him to do it for himself. And then at a time when it wasn't a live discussion, I would encourage you to offer ideas or thoughts. And then if he shoots you down because your other son at home might be defensive, I would expect that could be the case, then you retreat. The key to not becoming a participant in triggering resistance, the key is not in the first thing you say. It's after you say it and they have a response that's defensive or resistant. It's what you do next. And if you can let it go, you're fine. Apologize, let it go. Admit that you might be wrong, you're great. If you get committed to, attached to, if you get into a power struggle about the idea, that's when you become part of the problem, part of the resistance. All right, next question. Somebody says this: I've heard you say many times, learn to be okay with being wrong and get really good at losing, or you don't get to be right. I've taken it to heart and slowly learning to let go of being right. I can admit at times it feels very freeing. However, this has proven to be extremely challenging when it comes to my son. He says I'm being passive aggressive or suppressing my feelings when I don't engage or when I will agree with his choices, that his choices or opinions can be valid even if I don't agree with them. Any words of wisdom or are just one more thing that I need to be okay with? Well, I think you answered the question yourself there at the end. Yeah. I'll say to you this way, folks, because this is a great question and you're doing some great work. And you're right. At the end of the day, you don't get to be right. Even in being wrong, you don't get to be right at it. Okay. But the principle here is when healthy change begins in our families, in our relationships, other people in the relationships are going to be resistant to it, even us. When one person in a relationship or in a family changes for the better, makes an improvement, grows a little bit, gets out of an old pattern, the others in the family are going to engage in what we call in family systems therapy. We call it homeostasis, homeostatic resistance, which means they're going to want you to return to the status quo. It's going to feel uncomfortable. And so I think that their response to your change is natural. It might even be evidence that you're on track. But there's something. We seek for sameness, and they're trying to bring you back into an argument. And the fact of the matter is you've taken away their power. In this example, you've taken away their power because you're not arguing or power struggling. There used to be a poster on the office wall of a program that I worked at before we even started Evoke 22 years ago. And it said something like, if you argue with a teenager, it's like wrestling with a pig in the mud. The problem is that the pig enjoys it. And it's not just teenagers, it's anybody. And so you've taken away their power. And so, yes, it's going to grate on them. Yes, it's going to be upsetting. Yes, they're going to try to get you to go back to the old ways. But you don't have to. And you can just recognize it as homeostasis. And you can continue, like you said, to lose. Continue to just bumble your way through life, being your lovable, wonderful, numbskull person you are, and let them all laugh at you because you've learned to love yourself and it's okay. Next question. I'd like to know, at what point do siblings write to the kids at Evoke? Should it be a regular letter or hopes and intentions letter? Great question. It's really up to the therapist and up to the individual client. I'm not punting on this. It's just different for everybody. So ask your therapist for sure. Write that down. Ask your therapist because I can't answer the question for all of them. Even if you were talking about a caseload that I had of 7 to 9 students and you asked me, it wouldn't be the same for all of them. I'll give you some kind of typical scenarios. I would say probably about half of the time I'll have a sibling that's interested. Write a hopes and intentions letter. If that's not part of the, for whatever reason, not part of what I see to be helpful for the case, then I'll have them write maybe somewhere around midway, 3/4 of the way through the program. We don't want to take the energy and the focus off of mom and dad or stepmom and stepdad, off the primary parents, the primary caregivers. So we don't want to distract them with other outlets and avenues. We want to focus on. So those are typical kind of ideas, halfway, 3/4 of the way through the program. For me, about half the time, it's a hopes and intentions letter. Again, it depends if I think that's going to be helpful for the client in the program, for the student in the program, if I think they're going to be open to it. And oftentimes, the letters, the hopes and intentions letters from siblings make a bigger impact than the parents' letters because they're not coming at them as an authority figure. They're coming at them as a kind of an equal person. So they're more open to it. Next question. I'm pretty sure that the struggle of my son were mainly caused by me. I know I didn't do it on purpose, but I still did something wrong and hurt him. How can I fight guilt if I'm aware that I did my mistake, that I made my mistakes? That's a wonderful, powerful question. And my best answer is yes, we all dent our children. And we dent them because we're dented. And we were dented because our parents and those who raised us were dented. And you were taught to feel guilt because you were taught, like most everybody, that feeling guilt was a way to get better. That you feel bad for what you've done. And that when you feel bad for what you've done, you get better. But as therapists, we know it's more complicated than that. I can feel bad for something that I've done and still be stuck. My brain chemistry, my brain wiring, my patterns can still be off. I can still be triggered. I can still be reactive in a moment. I can still lose insight in a given interaction or moment. And me feeling guilty about it will have little to no effect. In fact, usually, the guilt actually makes it worse because I get defensive and I'm in denial and I don't want to look at it. So we learn to get rid of the guilt when we learn where it comes from. We learn to get rid of it when we really learn that originated in the what my therapist calls the mother tongue, the original language, and that it's just not true. We learn to get rid of guilt when we realize how much it lies to us, which it does almost all the time. Even in moments like this where it's triggering you to want to do something better or different for your child, it's not helping. If it was that simple, then we would, the minute we became aware of any skill or tool or insight, we would change, especially if it was paired with guilt. But we don't do that. So you learn to forgive yourself. You learn to heal yourself. That's why I'm so passionate about encouraging parents to go back and do their own work, to do their intensive work, to do their family therapy, their own therapy, their support group work, because when you heal the wounds of your childhood, that's it. You then are capable in those moments, in that way, of showing up for your child. And believe me this, I don't know personally, I don't know anybody who spent more time in the past 25 years thinking about parenting than me. I live and breathe it. Written a couple of books on it. I have over 1,200 broadcasts on the topic. I speak all over the world on the topic. And I say that with this caveat. I make mistakes all the time. I make mistakes every day. In fact, I'm more acutely aware of my mistakes now than I was 22, 25 years ago. And what I know with the utmost clarity is that my ability to be a good husband, a good friend, a good boss, a good father is tied to the emotional healing and work that I do, not to the information I have. That can assist a little bit, right? That can help some, but the fundamental element in change is healing. So, in summary, you do it because you're wounded. And feeling guilty for doing things because you're wounded doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, I get it because we all do it. But to feel badly because you've been injured and that injury causes you to hurt other people doesn't really lead to healing. It leads to suppression and to repression and to other defenses, justifying, rationalizing, intellectualizing. I could list all of the defenses. It leads to those things. So we kind of have to separate out our guilt from this idea of growth, of healing. As my child has left a Vogue and is settling in a therapeutic boarding school, I'm continuing my work through therapy, Adult Children of Alcoholics, or ACA, and CODA, or Codependents Anonymous. Exploring this idea of reluctance to set long-term personal goals, the codependent behavior of helping others achieve theirs, but not feeling I deserve them myself. I think this stems from my chaotic family of origin, always being on guard, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Any advice on ways to look at this and other advice on overcoming it? First of all, I wish I could see you, face to face and just tell you, you're doing it. It's a slower process than I would like to tell you. It takes time. That's why, as it relates to the last question, try to practice being kind to yourself. Find a therapist and a group that's kind to you. Find people around you that have compassion instead of judgments and shoulds and shouldn'ts. Extricate yourself from conversations where people give you advice or know your truth. Try to find conversations where people have them. In other words, try to surround yourself with compassionate people so that you'll begin to reprogram your brain to be compassionate instead of judgmental, guilting, and shaming. That's important. Just as we internalize the critical voices from our earlier contexts, we have to find new voices that are kind and compassionate towards us, being experiences, competing messages with those original contexts. So if we surround ourselves with people who give advice or that are critical, people that judge us, people that offer shoulds and shouldn'ts, people that purport to know our truth, we're continuing to program ourselves. So that's why part of this journey is about letting go. Part of this journey is about finding your people. And your people are, they're those people. I'm going to bring this up. It's people that say this to you. For those of you that are watching live, it's people that respond to you with the safe messages that I've listed. Thanks for telling me. Tell me more. If the people in your life, doesn't matter who they are saying things like, this is silly, you're overreacting, you're too sensitive, you're being selfish, you should. If those are the responses, if those are the interactions that you're experiencing in life, those aren't your people. Or at least tell them what you need or want, and if they can't respond, then they're not your people. They're not people that are going to encourage and support you and healing in the way that you need to, that we all need to. Someone asked, has Evoke ever hosted support groups for former clients post-program once they are home? We tried it a couple of times live. We haven't tried it online. We would do it if we thought we could get a showing. We've had several of them come to pursuit trips. We've had several of them come back for a field visit as a mentor. Many of them do that. We've had several of them come to our intensive program, but they haven't come back for support groups. And we would do it if there were an audience for it, really. But usually it's the parents who want the child to do it. So it's usually not the child who wants to do it. And as you all know, this is what led you to Evoke Wilderness Therapy in the first place. An outpatient therapy or something like a support group, you really have to be motivated somewhat internally. Wilderness therapy, you can get away with really low motivation and still have really great success. But for outpatient therapy or something like a support group, you really do have to be internally motivated for that. Next question, how do we balance setting boundaries versus allowing our son the space to make choices when it comes to reintroducing privileges when he returns home, such as time with friends, phone, social media, video games, etc. You might chuckle at this and say, thanks for nothing, Dr. Reedy, but take your best guesses. You've got the principle embedded in your question, which is you're trying to balance out boundaries with allowing them to make some choices. I think some key principles is really understanding that relapse, regression is not a black or white issue. It's not a pass or fail, but it's a process. I love the TED Talk by Johan Hari called Addiction and Connection. Johan Hari. I think the implications of that TED Talk are wonderful to consider when you're considering your boundaries. You know, I used to say this a lot. I used to say that I spent a lot of my time trying to get parents to embrace the mistakes and the setbacks and the detours as much as the successes. So you going back to the earlier things I was saying about doing your own work, the more you do your own work, the more stable and centered you are in the face of these kinds of detours and mistakes, and realizing that you want them to experiment with choice, right? You want them to be armed with the tools, the skills, the insights, the experience that you've given them, but then give them some choices. And there's almost like this bell-shaped curve, this curvilinear relationship where people start off kind of in denial and they wake up to all that was happening and they become really vigilant. And then they kind of learn to let go and give more choices. It's not denial. It's an aware version of parenting where you realize people are going to make mistakes. And so, again, it's a sensibility. So my tip is, it's such an art, folks. It's such an art. It's hard. You can't dictate the answer here. You can't say it perfectly. You can just talk about the principles and then support somebody in kind of a parent, in this case, kind of navigating their way through it. Keep listening. Keep doing your work. You know, go to the meetings. Understand where you are in relationship to your child and their problems. I'm sorry, it can be more concrete, but that's the truth of the answer for me. Thank you, Malia, for posting the TED Talk. Our son is at Evoc and was self-medicating anxiety and depression with marijuana. If it appears he would benefit from having medication as a part of his treatment, how do you make the determination? Also, what makes a child a good candidate for returning home versus a follow-up treatment? So there's a few big questions in here. First of all, ask your therapist at Evoc if medication might be an option. And the way that we think about medication is, does somebody need medication to access therapy? If therapy is making adequate progress, then therapy is making adequate progress. Does the therapist, who's not a medical doctor, suspect that the child could benefit from medication to access their therapy? If that's the case, then the therapist and you together can help set up a visit with our psychiatrist, with our psychiatric staff, and then they can determine if medication is necessary or might be helpful, and then they can monitor it going forward. So that's how we do that. The therapist refers them to the psychiatric staff with your support, with your request, and then the psychiatric staff. But we do it if we think that therapy is going to augment, excuse me, if medication is needed to augment the therapy significantly. And you're really looking at what are the pros and cons, what are the side effects, what are the upside and the downside of it. What makes a child a good candidate for returning home versus a follow-up? It's a multi-dimensional process that you kind of have to talk it through with a family. It has to do with the severity of their behavior, the risk level in their behavior, their age, finances. It has to do with finances because finances are practically one of the variables that will affect your ability to have them at these very expensive programs. It has to do with your work. It has to do in some part to, are you ready to manage it at home? Are you ready, capable, wanting to manage the ups and the downs? As I progressed in my career, I became less dogmatic about my recommendations. I became clear and I became more conservative as I went along in my recommendations, meaning I recommended more rather than less. By less dogmatic, I meant it's up to you. It's up to where you're at and what you want. And what I talk to my families about over the years is I won't challenge what you want to do. That's not my job. But I will challenge the thinking that goes into it. When the father said to me, I'm taking my adult son home because when he went away to college, he failed. And I'm going to make sure it doesn't happen again. I knew we had a problem still because the dad was thinking he could control it. That's a problem. When a parent feels guilty and feels like they need to reward their child or they don't want their child to be angry at them, those are problems, right? We look at those. We don't want the child taking care of the parents. We want the parent drawing their source of strength and esteem from somebody that isn't the child. So it's more of a thought process that we take you through. In the beginning of our program, you know, when we started Evoke 22 years ago, the idea that we came into it based on our experience at a previous wilderness program that no longer exists is that our experience tells us that when families get to this point, that they will often best be served by follow-up programs, out-of-home programs. So it is our experience that has told us that, not our theoretical position, right? Not where we come from theoretically, but experientially. It's our experience that tells us that. Again, Malia has shared with you the link for the TED Talk that I was talking about. Oh, I guess the name of it is Everything You Think You Know About Addiction Is Wrong. It's good clickbait material by Johan Hari. Next question. I'm learning to be more authentic with my son, a real person, not doing just the best parent I can. I'm struggling with how to address what I see as unhealthy behavior from my son's other parent without wanting to alienate. Any thoughts? Am I making the wrong question? No, that's the right question. I have a broadcast called Co-Parenting where I talk about it at length. And for the last parent, I do have a talking about coming home after Evoke too. There's a podcast on coming home after Evoke. That's part of what CODA's for. It's staying on your side of the street. And yes, the more work that you do, the more clear it's going to be. I will tell you, this is the most reassuring thing I can tell you about this. Well, I'll tell you the worst thing I can tell you about this question and the best. The worst part of this question, the reason I hate this question is because I have no great answer. Because in reality, when you're working with a co-parent who's not on the same page, who's not willing to do their work, who's still stuck in old patterns, you're working in a fight that is where one hand is tied behind your back. That's the truth. You can still win. You just have one hand tied behind your back. But here's the good news. The research has shown us. This is clear. In fact, I wrote a journal article on this and a dissertation on this. The research is clear. The children just need one person, one parent who sees them. One parent who has a sense of self that can see them, that's consistent in their life, that makes a difference as they grow up. Ideally, two would be great, but one makes all the difference. So stay on your side of the street, listen to the podcast on co-parenting. It's easy to become part of the problem by focusing on what the other parent is doing. Just stay clear, get support, do your work, and be gentle with yourself in the process because you are fighting a fight with a hand tied behind your back, for sure. Looks like that's all the questions we have. I'll go through the upcoming announcement, see if any other come in. For those of you who don't know who might be listening, you can contact Evoke's Wilderness Therapy Program by contacting our admissions at admissions@evoketherapy.com. We deal with I don't ever talk about this, but we, because I assume that everybody listening is a wilderness therapy parent, but they're not, of course. And so if you're curious about the version of therapy that we do, you can contact our admissions department. We take students 18 to 28. If you want to do a deep dive into your own work, you can attend our Evoke intensives that are also online right now. We have them online and in person. Upcoming dates are on our website. The upcoming in-person Finding You is September 16th. I think we have one more spot that'll be filled any day now. Also, we're doing Finding You online later in September, and then Finding You 2 also will be later in September online. We have an Embracing You program, which is all run by all women of color for women of color. So if you are a person of color or you know somebody that's a person of color, this is a specifically designed program for women of color. For more information, contact intensives at evoketherapy.com. Our Pursuits adventure trips are from 3 to 30 days. They can be done as standalone, or they can be attached to the transition from wilderness therapy before the next step, even if you didn't go to Evoke. It's a separate program altogether. Parent support groups, our upcoming support groups are listed here September 3rd, 10th, and 17th for alumni parents. If you are current or alumni parents, if you want to get support, meet other parents, or if you are an alumni of our intensive support intensive program, September 8th and 13th, October 13th. We ask all current parents to go to 12-step support groups. All of these podcasts can be found on any of your podcast platform by just searching Finding You in Evoke Therapy Podcast or on SoundCloud.com. For Twitter and Instagram, you can find at Evoke Therapy on Twitter and Instagram and at Evoke Therapy Intensives on Instagram. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. Find the Family Foundation at EvokeFamilyFoundation.org or on Facebook and, of course, our blog. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are both available on Amazon. The audiobook will be out any day now, I hope this week. It's been submitted and pending approval. The audiobook will be on Audible and iTunes for The Audacity to Be You. The Journey of the Heroic Parent already has an audiobook version. All right, are there any other questions that have come in, Leah? No more. All right, folks, thank you for joining us. Thank you for all of your questions. Thank you for and on behalf of your loved ones for attending something like this. I'm really excited. I love this next subject. On Wednesday night, 5:30 p.m. Mountain Time, I'll be talking about inner child, the construct, the idea, the model of our inner child and what that means. I'll try to take it out of the psychobabble kind of woo-woo therapy and make it a really theoretically grounded, compelling idea for us to understand ourselves. So take care, folks. Have a great evening. Talk to you on Wednesday. Bye-bye. Better year you'll be. Better year you'll cover me. There's a hole inside my head, leaking at the same sense. Talk no time. Slowly chose.